Welcome to the Last Round MMA.
The guy's never beaten me. In order to be the champion, you have to beat the champion.
A podcast for the MMA fan.
Imagine that. Look at everybody up here. They're all dressed like me. They're all trying to talk like me. They're all trying to be me.
Bringing you in-depth interviews and more from across the MMA world.
This is like pride. You know, everybody's here. I feel great. And, you know, I can't wait. Saturday night, I'm going to crush this guy hype.
Are you ready? Let's start the show.
Episode 3 of the Last Round MMA podcast. And today's special guest, we have combat sports broadcaster Sean Wheelock. Thanks for joining me, Sean.
Michael, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you reaching out and having me on the show.
No, of course, of course. Trying to vary up. We've had some fighters, some cut men. So obviously today we'd have to get someone on the other side, sports broadcaster like yourself. So no better place to start than, you know, how did you end up getting into this crazy world of combat sports?
Yeah, so I'm a kid who always loved sports. And I always loved fighting, but not as a tough guy, not as a thug type. I just was attracted to it. If I didn't have a lot of fights as a kid, I generally, my personality, I get along with people, but I was just interested in fighting. I started watching boxing really before I watched any other sport. I was raised by my mom, but I would spend most Fridays with my dad, and he was a huge boxing fan, loved pro wrestling, anything that I could watch. We had the old tough man contest that my dad would take me to, where I saw some of the worst beatings I ever have in my life. And I was just naturally attracted to it. November 12th, 1993, you can see the poster behind me. Actually, that's the UFC 1 poster. I saw that poster and I thought, I need to see this. It might be a work, it might be pro wrestling, but it quite possibly could be real fighting. And my mom paid the $14.95, and that forever changed my life. So I knew as a kid, I always wanted to be a commentator. I have a theory that people who aren't overly athletic, but who love sports, usually get jobs as commentators. So if we were more athletic, we would get jobs as athletes. But when we can't go that route, then we become commentators. And that was it for me. But again, you know, even as a kid, like if there was a fight at school, I just wanted to see the fight. I was just interested in fighting. And I kept that with me my whole life. Never, as I said, from being a thug or trying to be a tough guy or anything like that, but just naturally being attracted to that. Boxed as a kid, wrestled. I'm from Kansas. You kind of have to, whether you like it or not. I happen to like it. Found Sambo early into jiu-jitsu. Just love the lifestyle, love combat sports.
So what was it that caught your attention, you know, specifically in the UFC 1?
It was the kick of Gerard Gordeau and Taylor Tooley's face. I had never seen anything like that. Even Mike Tyson at his most ferocious, or Julio Cesar Chavez, I had never seen anything like that. And it's funny, I looked back, I wrote about this, the book that I did on with Art Davey, the creator of UFC, Is This Legal? Our book, at the end of the book, and it's Art's memoir of how he created UFC, but at the end, I write a chapter in my own voice, or a mini chapter, really, just about that experience of watching UFC 1 live November 12th, 1993. I remember that at that age, that high school age, that teenager age, I always went to fight parties. So much of my social life was with my friends and watching Mike Tyson or watching Chavez or Holyfield or Pernell Whitaker, going to fight parties. But on UFC 1, I distinctly remember it was a Friday night, and I was kind of embarrassed that I ordered it because I thought it might be really bad pro wrestling. But I had read about this thing called shoot fighting in Japan, and I remember that the author, I don't remember the publication, but I remember the author wrote, this is like real pro wrestling. And I was hoping it was going to be like that. I hadn't seen anything from Pancrase or Shooto or rings, but I knew it existed and I was hoping it would be this. But I remember watching UFC 1 alone, which is the only time I think I ever remember watching fights alone, because I didn't want my friends to come over and then it was some dopey pro wrestling that was really bad. Even though I loved WWF at the time, I think, oh man, I got suckered in, or at least my mom did, paying the $14.95. But that kick to the face, and you can see the tooth fly out, and the explosion of blood, and then the right hand bare-fisted, the knuckle in the Taylor Tooley's eye. I thought, wow, this is real. Not only is this what I hoped it would be, it's so much better. And I was instantly hooked on that from that one moment. And, you know, I'm from a Kansas City suburb called Shawnee, Kansas. So these names on this poster, I mean, they were like mysterious words to me. Like, what is jujitsu? I had never heard of jujitsu in 1993. I knew shoot fighting. What is savate? I have no idea. What is taekwondo? I'm embarrassed to tell you, it was an Olympic sport from 88. I had no idea what taekwondo was. In my world, there was boxing, there was wrestling, there was pro wrestling, and then there was martial arts. And I didn't really know what martial arts was. I didn't know the difference between judo. I'd never heard of jujitsu. These were just kind of mysterious, made up words to me. And I was drawn in immediately.
So how did you make the transition from obviously, you know, just loving the sport and deciding, you know what, I want to be a commentator, to actually doing it? Did you go to journalism school? Did you get a degree?
Yeah, no, I'm proudly a college dropout. College wasn't for me. I went to Arizona State University. I come from some pretty educated people. My mom is a retired art teacher. My late father was a college professor. I have educators, a lot of professors, people with doctorates and PhDs and EdDs and master's. But I'm a college dropout from a state university who talks about people getting struck in the head for a living proudly. So college wasn't for me, because when I got there, I thought, I'm here wasting time when I need to be at a radio station or a TV station. I was driven from a young age, and I mean a young age, 6, 7, 8 years old, that I wanted to be a commentator. You know, I'm old enough to, and maybe you are, Michael, to remember when you actually had cassette tapes and tape recorders. And I still have tapes of me at 7, 8 years old doing mock play-by-play or a mock sports broadcast, trying to emulate that. I was so driven. So when I got to college, I thought, I'm just wasting my time. And after 2.5 years, I got a proper commentating job that paid a little bit of money. And I moved back home to Kansas City and moved back home in my mom's house, my childhood home, and started that and never looked back. You know, it's a weird road becoming a professional commentator. So weird, in fact, and I love trying to give people advice when they reach out to me, and I tell them there are no straight lines. If somehow miraculously I woke up 18 years old tomorrow with all of the knowledge that I have now, I still don't know that I would be able to figure out the business any quicker than I did. It's a weird mix of timing and hard work and opportunity, and someone hearing you or seeing you and liking what you do and giving you the chance. It's the conundrum, especially as a fight commentator. It's very difficult to get big shows until you've done big shows, but how do you get that big show? For me, I was extremely fortunate. We can talk about this on your program, that I got Pride. I was the last English language commentator in Pride. I think it was the second to last person actually hired by Pride. And Pride led to M1, and M1 led to Bellator. And then Bellator, after 5.5 years, blew everything wide open for me. But it's a lot of starting when you're a teenager, as I did, 18, 19, 20 years old when I was in college, and working as an intern, working as a runner, getting really low paying minimum wage radio shifts. I got an indoor soccer commentary gig when I was right after college, I think. And it was my second gig, not the one that brought me home, but my second one. And I got paid $50 a game, and it was fantastic. I had a job covering the Kansas City Royals for the big FM station, KY102, which was a huge FM station at the time. They paid me $10 a game, and I was thrilled for the $10. It covered my gas. I just wanted the media credential and the access. It was just willing myself into this business, not knowing anyone who knew anyone, or even knowing anyone who knew anyone who knew anyone. And I knew that I wanted to be in this business, and I knew I wanted to work in fighting. Getting into the business was one thing. Getting a fight job was another, because even now, you and I were just talking off air, it's scarce on the fight jobs. You think about 15 years ago, there were like 3 English-speaking fight jobs on the planet. And I was fortunate enough to get one of those 3.
So the first one was
Pride. Pride was my big break. So the story on that, Michael, is I was working in soccer. I was very fortunate. Timing is a big thing for me, and I'm the beneficiary of a lot of good timing, knock on wood, in my life. Major League Soccer started when I was in my early 20s, and I had played soccer in high school, and I was a huge soccer fan. So I was able to get work where 5 years later, if I had been 5 years younger, it would have been too late, or 5 years later, maybe I would have been too old. But it was the timing, and they were willing to take a chance on a kid just because I knew soccer. But more realistically, the accomplished commentators didn't want to commentate soccer in the United States. So I wasn't going against the most accomplished or talented people. I was able to get in and get work. I was very fortunate on that. I wound up getting hired by ESPN. I wound up getting hired by Fox International. I did the World Cup in 2006, and this was a huge turning point in my career. I was in Germany for 39 days. I got back and I thought, I'm still young enough to where I can make a career decision and make a move. I can be a soccer commentator, but I've kind of topped out. I've done the World Cup. I've worked for ESPN. I've worked for Fox. I want to push myself. So a buddy of mine, Joe Kelly, a fellow Kansas Cityan, who I had already known by that point, at least 7 or 8 years, was a boxing promoter. And then he started the promotion Titan FC. He was the original owner of Titan. I went to Joe and I said, you know, through my TV connections locally in Kansas City doing soccer, I think I can get Titan on. And if I do that, will you let me commentate? He said, of course. I was able to get Titan on. We did a handful of Titan shows. I read on the internet that Mauro Ranallo had left Pride. I knew there was an opening. I knew they had used Lon McCarron and Damon Perry and hadn't settled on anyone. And I cold called the Pride offices in Los Angeles. I sent them a DVD of my work, a highlight reel, or at least I thought it was a highlight. It was probably a mediocre light reel, but a reel nonetheless. And it got me a meeting in Los Angeles, and that got me hired by Pride. And I phased out of soccer. It took me about 3 years fully to phase out of soccer, and all the way into Bellator in 2010. And that was the line then that, all right, you're going to commit fully. Gave up all my soccer work and full-time in MMA since 2010, or at least in combat sports.
So what kind of background did you have to work on to commentate on Pride? Because there's so many different moves. There's so many, when you knew you were going to go into combat sports, did you decide to, you know, take up MMA yourself so you could sound, you know, kind of not more knowledgeable about each, you know, armbar, each submission?
Yeah, it's a great question. And again, so I'm someone who was always attracted to it. I mean, I was a terrible wrestler, but I did understand folk style wrestling from being a kid in Kansas. I had a basic understanding of boxing. I boxed a little bit, again, poorly. Again, remember, if I were a great athlete, I would try to be a fighter. You'd be interviewing a fighter and not a commentator. And I'd done Sambo, and from Sambo, it got into jiu-jitsu. And it was funny. I just wanted a grappling school. And I remember looking around Kansas City, and I had kind of a vague awareness of Sambo. And I started Sambo. I really thought it was going to be more jiu-jitsu, but it was Sambo. But then there were elements of judo and jiu-jitsu. So when I got to Pride, it was so helpful to me, so easy for me, not easy, that's the wrong word. It was easier that I knew how to put on a kimura so I could recognize a kimura. I knew how to put on an inside heel hook so I could recognize that. And I remember thinking, God, if I hadn't trained, even though I wasn't very good, if I hadn't trained, I would be lost on that. And Pride was an amazing experience. Frank Trigg was my broadcast partner, and you know, here's a guy he had never heard of coming in. All he knew was I was a young guy and a soccer commentator. Trigg was awesome to me. We're still friends, 16, 17 years later. Trigg is phenomenal. Jerry Millen, who's a name kind of lost to history, unfortunately, in MMA. But in that era, in the early and mid-2000s, first decade of the 2000s, Jerry Millen, after Dana White, was the most powerful American executive in MMA. He ran the LA offices, the American offices for Pride. Jerry was phenomenal to me. Jerry's a lifelong friend now. Jerry's one of my closest friends all these years later. We spoke last week. Manages Fedor Emelianenko now, by the way. It was a great experience with Pride. I learned so much. And at the time, I was a bigger Pride fan than I was a UFC fan. I had fallen in love with Pride through their DVDs and ordering on Netflix. You could find the UFC as a Blockbuster, but you could find the, at least where I lived, but you could find the Pride DVDs on Netflix. And I, even though I still watch the UFC, I thought Pride's a superior product. So to say that it was surreal, Michael, when I was hired at Pride and I was at Saitama Super Arena, I thought, wow. And it was an amazing experience going in. You can still see those. It's on UFC Fight Pass. And I don't feel that I'm very good. At the time, I thought I was good. Looking back, I can see how naive I was. And even though I had done a World Cup in soccer, I was naive on fighting. And there's an evolutionary process. But Jerry Millen, Trigg, everyone, Saki Kibara, everyone made me feel extremely welcome. And it was a really cool experience for a first big show.
Were there any commentators you looked up to or anyone you kind of based your style on?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my broadcasting hero is Pat Summerall. Now, I don't know when you moved to the U.S., and I'm going to tell you an Englishman who I still like a lot, who I have a lot of influence on that. But Pat Summerall was an NFL player. He was largely a kicker. He became, for me, the ultimate play-by-play commentator. And if you know who John Madden is, Michael, I think a lot of people in the audience certainly know John Madden, who just passed away. John Madden became John Madden because Pat Summerall was the ultimate minimalist. You have to have a mix of personalities, is my belief on commentary. And because John Madden was very big and boom, and this happens, Pat Summerall was a real minimalist, great voice, deep voice, very minimalist. And I loved his inflections. I loved his cadence. And I went to school on that. But I mean, as a kid, I mean, I'm talking in grade school and in junior high school, I would note who the commentators were. I was that obsessive on it that I would actually think, all right, well, okay, Don Kroenke is doing this NFL game. That's awesome. Ken Wilson is doing this National Hockey League game. That's awesome. But Summerall, for me, I fell in love watching English Premier League soccer in the 96-97 campaign. And I immediately gravitated to Martin Tyler. I've met Martin Tyler a few times. He's a gentleman. He's a lovely guy. For you certainly know who he is, Michael. For maybe the non-soccer fan audience or maybe the non-British audience watching your show, Martin Tyler, to me, is the dean of football soccer commentators in the United Kingdom. And, you know, I blatantly rip off certain things from commentators I admire. Martin Tyler, the way he calls a goal and shuts up, how I've influenced my commentary, when I call a knockout or a submission and then shut up, that's directly stolen from Martin Tyler. It's the inflections, it's the cadence, it's bringing your voice up, bringing it down here and bringing it back up, not just talking for talking's sake. So as a kid, Pat Summerall, and then into my 20s and into my 30s, Martin Tyler for sure.
How did you practice then before your first Pride show?
Yeah, you know, it's weird because I had done MMA with Titan. I had called boxing as well. Not a lot, but I commentated boxing. And I was a really experienced soccer commentator. You know, again, I had done soccer for ESPN, for Fox International. I had done a World Cup. So there was no practice for me. It was just putting together my notes, my fighter interviews. That's something I recognized early on, almost when I started over preparing, and there's a way to do that. But, you know, I believe that there are some things as a commentator you can control and some you can't. You know, people can try to flatten out their accent. I'm fortunate that I come from the part of America that it has a pretty neutral accent. You know, people who come from different regions of the United States, you know, this is an Englishman. Some accents work better than others, and people from certain parts of the United States have to change their accent. For me, I didn't have to do that. I naturally have this Midwest, what's called a general American accent, I think, by linguists, but figuring out rhythm, figuring out timing. But, you know, some people are going to like your voice, some people aren't. Some people are going to like your accent, some people aren't. There's really not much you can do that about that as a commentator. What you can always control as a commentator is your preparation, your work ethic. So I felt like I had that when I got to Pride, and I made sure that I had that. So it wasn't a matter of practicing, like sitting in my hotel room in Japan, running over stuff. It was just being prepared. You know, I knew it was for MMA, it was surreal, but having done some big things like the World Cup definitely helped on that show. Had I not had that soccer experience, I probably would have been eaten alive doing Pride. So even though I was relatively new in MMA, I had already been a professional commentator by that point since my very early 20s. So like about a full decade of my life.
It may sound like a silly question because obviously the different sports, but is there a huge difference in commentating boxing, MMA, M1, soccer in the terms of how you have to do your style?
Yeah, no, that's not a silly question at all. It's a fantastic question. So, you know, a couple of things I pride myself on. Definitely I pride myself on my work effort, that if I'm doing a show and it's a pro debuter against an 0-1 kid, they're getting the same 15, 20 minute fighter interview. They're getting the same preparation. They're getting my same best effort as if I'm doing a main event. And that's just, I treat every fighter in every fight the same. Big John McCarthy is one of my best friends, and we've talked about that. And I know John has brought that philosophy to his commentating at Bellator. And we talked about when he was a referee, it's like John would show up at these little house shows in California, or he might show up at a house show in Minnesota or Kansas. People look at him like, wow, John, why are you here? He's like, well, because it's a fight. And John and I talked about, if he was doing a house show in Kansas or doing a UFC main event, it was the same John. It's like John's not going to try less hard as a referee because it's a small show. That's the philosophy he had as a referee, as a commentator. That's the philosophy I've always had as a commentator. If I'm putting my voice to it and someone thought enough of me to hire me and pay me money, I'm doing my best effort. So whether that's Triller or BKFC or a small show I'm doing on Fight or Fight Pass, if I've said yes and you've been nice enough to ask me, you're going to get my 100% effort. There's no different levels of that. So I'm a huge believer in your prep, and it shows. You know, I'm not going to name names. That's just not my style, but there have been plenty of commentators who have come into combat sports, especially MMA, because it's so much more intricate, obviously, than boxing. And I'll talk about that in a second, who've been found out. And the reason I say it's so much more intricate, look, is human beings, as adults, we kind of have an understanding of what a punch looks like or a kick. Now, you may not understand what a teep is or a crescent kick. You know, you might not understand what an up jab is, but you kind of have an understanding of basic punches or strikes, at least punches. Most adults do. When you're talking about getting into MMA, do you really know what the difference is between an anaconda and a darce? Do you really understand the difference between a toe hold and an Achilles lock? Very technical things like that. And, you know, there are plenty of commentators who have done the work and they've figured that stuff out, and there are plenty who haven't and they've never figured that out. And, you know, a lot of that is based on personality coming in. But in terms of how I call fights, you know, I pride myself on my preparation. I pride myself on the fact that I do MMA, I do bare knuckle, Triller Triad, Muay Thai, Letway, submission grappling. The cadences, the rhythms are pretty much the same. You know, I'm a big grappling nerd, so it's so much fun when I've commentated submission grappling, like Submission Underground for Chael Sonnen, because you can really delve deep and you're seeing submissions that you're just not going to see in MMA through practicality. That rhythm, that pacing is the same because you're in rounds. It's a relatively concise thing. Soccer, football is a different thing altogether because you're looking at a 90-minute match. You know, there could be extra time depending on the competition. You have to pace yourself differently accordingly. What I have found as a commentator, though, is the big moment inflections are the same. If anyone's ever heard me commentate soccer, which I have not done in a while, but it's still the same inflections. If there's a buildup to a goal, I'm raising up, similar to how if I feel like there's a finish about to come in combat sports, I'm raising up the goal scored or the finish comes in fighting. And like I talked about with Pat Summerall, I'm laying out, I'm letting the sound of the crowd, the moment, I'm letting that breathe. Similar rhythms on that. I look at some sports, baseball, golf, auto racing. Man, I wouldn't have a clue how to commentate those. I really wouldn't. And I think that my cadences and my rhythms would be all wrong. Not that anyone is calling me for those jobs, but if they did, I think I would have to politely decline because I really would have no idea how to even inflect, how to even start on something like that.
How do you prep for a fight? Because probably what, a month or two ago. Obviously, there was that big thing about Daniel Cormier was supposedly paying somebody to prep for him. So
yeah,
what does a fight week look for you in terms of preparation?
Yeah, no, another good man. You're asking me some great questions. So for instance, on a typical bare knuckle, we were just at Knuckle Mania, right? Saturday night show. I'm getting in on Wednesday. 9 a.m. on Thursday morning, I start the fighter interviews. There were 12 fights on that card. One fell out, but we had already done the fighter interview. So that's 24 fighters that I'm meeting with, depending on how talkative they are, 15 to 20 minutes. And again, that's whether it's Chad Mendez or whether it's or Zion Tomlinson on the prelims, they're getting the same fighter interview. So I'm doing that. I'm typing in my laptop, and I give every fighter and anyone who's watched this who I've commentated knows the speech, which is, this is just for me. This doesn't go public. This isn't in front of the camera. I'm not recording. I'm typing notes. So I'm asking them questions about their training, how they view their opponent, what they're looking to do, things like that. Obviously, the questions are a little different in MMA. We're talking about ground, or if it were going to be Muay Thai, or if it were bare knuckle or whatever combat sport, but it's essentially the same line of questioning. I'm trying to get in their head. And I tell every fighter, every fight that I do, I want to see the fight through your eyes, and I want to see the fight through your opponent's eyes. How that plays out in my broadcast, if, for instance, you'll see me say to my commentating partner, we'll say, you know, he told us that he was going to establish the jab and he has done so to that point. Or she said that she did not want to play close guard, but she continues to play close guard in this fight. That's brought back directly from those fighter meetings. Everyone has different prep, and I don't judge anybody. Whatever gets you there. What gets me there is sitting down and talking with the fighters. So I'm typing those in my laptop. I'm looking at that. And then I'll put them into what I call my spotting board, which is it'll have the fighter's name, their city, their height, their weight, their trunk colors. And then I'm taking what I think are the most germane points off of that. What are the key things that they're telling me they're looking to do? They're looking out from their opponent. They're focusing on keys to victory, all of that, really trying to delve deep into their strategy. What is their corner telling them? What can they not let their opponent accomplish? So that's there. I'll type it out. I'm not even looking at that so much when I'm commentating, but just by the sheer act of typing out, it helps lock it into my brain. And not everything that I've put there I'm using, and I don't feel compelled I have to use every note, but it's there and it can add to it and really kind of build the story. I don't script any lines. I don't script any notes. I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. It's very read and react. I know there are commentators who will script certain things. I don't know how they do that. That is such an unbelievably strange concept to me, but I have an idea. What helps me is that because first and foremost, I'm a combat sports guy. I love watching fights. So what is research is also me being me. If I had a completely different life and a completely different career, I'm still watching those fights. So because I'm in the combat sports world, that's kind of my research being done for me. So that really helps. But I might go back and I might watch a video from a certain thing. I might want to reference and look at a couple of things. But it really is in the fighter meetings, extrapolating those comments into notes and just building around that. But it's a fine line, Michael, because you don't want to be over noted. Which is what I did when I started soccer when I was very young. I had like 25 things on every player. Well, there's a ball getting kicked around. You need to worry about that. But I don't know how commentators come in cold. And again, I think Cormier is fantastic. I don't criticize anybody. I can tell you there are shows that I work on. Bare Knuckle is not one, but there are shows that I work on where you'll get a packet of research notes. And I don't want to break it to the researcher. I've never looked at those once. I want to hear it from the fighter. It's not even I don't trust those notes. It's that I want to hear it. And so often when you're interviewing fighters, it's not the answer that you get. It's the way that they answer the question. Mm. You're looking for confidence. If you've done someone multiple times, are they acting differently? If so, how? Are they more confident, less confident? Are they quieter? Are they having trouble making eye contact? All of those things inform my commentary. And they do it subtly and they do it overtly.
when you're doing the interview questions before the fight, can you share with us some of the questions that you asked?
Oh, yeah.
Are they different every time, depending on the fighter?
So everyone, different personalities. We get non-English speakers. You know, there are fighters who I have legitimate friendships with, and there are fighters I'm meeting for the first time. Some people know who I am, and they're excited to meet me. There are a lot of fighters, they have absolutely no idea who I am, and they're like, why is this guy asking me questions? You know, I pride myself on my neutrality. Chris Lights Out Lytle is not only the best broadcast partner I've ever had, he's also one of my best friends. We were talking earlier today. If Chris commentated a fight, if Chris fought again, I don't know if he will or not, but if Chris fought again and I'm commentating, I would be neutral to the point that you would have no idea that we were had that level of relationship, because I'm going to switch that off in my brain. Of course, I'm going to want Chris to win, but I'm not going to want him to win while I'm commentating, because that's a disservice to the audience. No one wants to see a biased commentator. That's for certain, at least not in individual sports. Maybe in team sports, it's acceptable. I never did that in football and soccer. Maybe in certain elements, I think in college sports, which I've never commentated, I think there's an expectation that you're kind of biased or openly rooting for the university or college that you're commentating for. But as far as I know, in individual sports, certainly in combat sports, it drives people crazy. I would never do it. It's not even anything consciously I have to say don't do. I'm just there to be neutral, to describe what is going on. That's the way that I see that. But typical fighter questions, Michael, if you're fighting, I'm saying, tell me about your training camp, Michael. What have you been working on? I'm going to say, break down your opponent for me. Where do you see them strong? Where do you see the holes in their game? I'm going to say, what's important to you? What are your coaches telling you to do in this? What are your best punches? Again, I'm tailoring it for the sport, but if it's MMA, we'll talk about, tell me about your ground game. You know, tell me what's your background. If I knew that you were a black belt, I'm going to ask certain questions. If I knew you were a Division I college wrestler, certain questions. If I knew that you were a judo Olympian, certain questions. Describe your fighting style for me. If I've had you multiple times as a fighter, I'm going to say, what are you going to show me different in this fight? What's different? Tell me about your evolution. I'm very big in you tell me about your opponent. This is why I say the sanctity of the fighter interview in that I don't share it. No one's going to know that until the fight started. And by that time, it cannot be used against you. I'm going to give you an example of that in a moment. But what can you not let your opponent do? I can't let my opponent hold me down. I can't let my opponent turn this into a jiu-jitsu match. I can't let my opponent fight in the pocket. Those are the answers that I get. It's the same line of questioning, but different questions, different pace, different rhythm, depending on who's in front of me. So an example of this, so in BKFC Knuckle Mania, Fames, Joshua Alvarez, who lost to Chad Mendes, we're in the fighter meeting and give him the whole speech. And it's the third time I've commentated Josh. He's a really good guy, by the way. And as is Mendes, of course. And I'm like, you know, from before, Josh, always in confidence. He goes, right, you don't tell anyone. I go, 100%, never have, never will. Said, my camp, I've switched lefty for this. I'm gonna confuse Mendes because the whole camp is a switch lefty. I specifically held on to that. I didn't even say it when he walked out until the bell rang, because on the off chance that someone heard that while he was walking out, they would maybe text to Mendes's corner and they'd say, he's going to start lefty. That's how serious I take this. Once the fight started, you see Chad Mendes or you see Fames against Mendes in southpaw and lefty. I said on the commentary, this is what he told us in our fighter meeting. He's an ortho fighter who's been training southpaw, and he wants to confuse Mendes from that. And we talked about that. That's the type of insight that you can only get from fighters meetings. And I don't even know if a researcher would have the trust to pull that out from a fighter, which is why, no disrespect to the researchers, I never look at those notes.
Have you ever actually had a fighter fall out with you due to your position as commentary? Like, you know, you said something they didn't like.
You know what? Knock on wood, I haven't, thankfully. I've heard a lot, and it's usually after I've commentated with someone. Man, your partner hated me, or this guy hated me, or something. I've never said anything. I've had a few fighters, and they're usually less experienced. They'll be like, why did you say this? I'm like, brother, I didn't say that. That was my broadcast partner. You'll have to ask them. you know, I believe that I have not earned the right to criticize because I'm not a professional fighter. However much I know or believe that I know about fighting, at the end of the day, I'm not a professional fighter. But it's not in my nature to criticize anyway. And I don't see that as the role of play-by-play. You know, for me, commentary, people have a tendency to look at it. I'll give you an example. So my wife is English, but she's not a football fan, a soccer fan. When she sees a match, she just sees 20 guys running around and two guys standing still. She doesn't really understand the difference between what the left back does and what the number 10 does and what the striker does. She just kind of sees people running. People oftentimes who haven't worked in TV or even people who do work in TV hear the commentating and they just hear two or three or four people talking. It's very distinct, different roles. I'm the play-by-play commentator. As the play-by-play commentator, I'm really telling you about the who and the what. I'm not biased. I'm not rooting for anyone. I'm not criticizing anyone. I'm telling you the who and the what, keeping this moving. The color commentator, what Chris Lytle is, what Daniel Cormier is, what Bisping is, what Roy Jones did on HBO. Generally, they're former athletes, former fighters across all sport. They can be more critical. They can be more analytical. And I'll remind that when I recently did an MMA show on UFC Fight Pass called Fighting Alliance Championship. And I commentated with Jeff Molina and Julian Marquez, who are both in the UFC. And I said, guys, you can criticize because you're in the UFC and you've earned that right. But criticizing doesn't mean this guy is terrible. This guy shouldn't be in the cage. It means they're not effectively sitting down on their punches, or they're being very loose with their guard, or they're accepting bottom position, or they told us in our fighter meeting that they had the fight on the outside and throw the jab, but they have not thrown the jab once. Those are the critical insights that they can give because they're fighters. So for me, it is naturally fighters aren't going to hear anything critical that I would say. But yeah, it's happened a lot, especially in one promotion I used to commentate for, where I've had numerous, and I mean like numerous, fighters say, man, your partner was against me. I'm like, well, you have to talk to him, and we haven't worked together in a long time. But they'll see the bias there. I never hear that with Chris Lytle, though, and I don't think Chris is biased at all, and he's not. You know, sometimes there are commentators who want people to win. I'm not that commentator. I'm certainly not on the air. You know, I have friends fight virtually every card that I commentate. I have a friend fight on. But once that show starts, I truthfully do not care who wins. It makes no difference in my life.
Can you remember the first fighter you ever interviewed?
It would have been at Pride. That's a great question. Actually that's not true because I would have done the Titan shows before. I don't, because it wasn't like, it was a workaday process. It's workflow. So it wasn't like, oh my God, I'm interviewing this fighter. And again, I started in radio when I was 18 years old, right out of high school. So I already had that background. So while some things were new to me, some things were familiar. So I can tell you first shows that I did, first events. In terms of the workaday process, I don't really recall that. But I like in Pride, I think Ricardo Arona, who I was a big fan of, I remember he was one of our first fighter meetings, but not to that point. It's weird. It, even though you're a fan of people, you know, you're there to ask questions and solicit answers. And while you want to show respect, and I think of myself as a naturally respectful person, you don't want to fanboy out on anyone either, because then that loses credibility. You're there to do a job. They're there to do a job. You're all professionals and you should act as such, in my opinion.
Any interviews you've ever been nervous for, just because maybe you're a fan of them or it's such a big interview that you need it to go well?
Yeah, so it's weird. So no, that's a great question. And you got to remember too, my interviews are low stakes because it's me sitting in a room, generally with my broadcast partner, generally with the fighter, and they might have one or two people. So it's not being recorded. So I'm doing it as a function to solicit answers. I'm not doing it for entertainment value. You're interviewing me for an audience, for, I don't know how entertaining I am, but presumably for entertainment value. when I'm interviewing a fighter, I'm doing it for one reason, and that's to solicit the answers that I want, entertainment, or not entertainment, but for my notes that I that put onto the broadcast, which hopefully is relatively entertaining. But I don't have to follow any cohesive narrative in my questions to keep a third party, be it the audience, entertained. I'm asking those questions that I need to ask to get the answers that I need. And if I feel I've accomplished that in 12 minutes, the interview is over. If it takes me 28 minutes, then the interview is over. So I'm not constricted by that. I think the only time I felt nervous very early in my radio career, I was covering, which gives you an insight of the type of thing I did. I was doing a college baseball regional. I wasn't even the commentator. I was there. It was at Wichita State University. I was doing it for Kansas City Radio, I think KMBZ Radio. And I was reporting on this college baseball regional. And Kevin Costner was there. And this is like the height of Kevin Costner fame. And this is like mid-90s Kevin Costner. And, you know, Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, Tin Cup, Kevin Costner. And I don't remember the school. I think it was like Cal State Fullerton, maybe. But he somehow had a relationship with the school or was friends with the coach or the athletic director. And Kevin Costner was there. And I approached him, and he was as big a star as there was in the world, and asked for an interview. And he was very gracious to me. I remember being nervous on that. I don't recall ever being nervous with an athlete. And now, like, for instance, I'll tell you, I think Chad Mendes is awesome. And when I met Chad, I was like, bro, I'm really an admirer of you as a fighter. I'm so happy I get to commentate you in BKFC. But it's not a nervous type of thing. I think there are people who would make me nervous, but I don't think any of those people are actually athletes, because I work around athletes.
Is there any, you know, hints or tips for people that want to follow in your footsteps? Because, you know, sometimes during fight week, fighters don't want to talk much, and they do get sick of the same questions over and over again. Like, how's camp been? Right. Obviously, they're going to say really well. So is there anything that you've learned over time to kind of settle them down and maybe throw a few curveball questions in that make them think?
So again, it starts with letting them know why I'm doing the interview, that this is for my notes only. And then if I'm meeting someone for the first time, we'll find common ground. Whatever that common ground, if they're Russia, I'll tell them that I've commented from one. I've been to Russia about 30 times. If they're English, I'll mention that I have an English wife. If they're a fellow Midwesterner, I'll say, oh, I'm from Kansas. Oh, wow. You're from Oklahoma. You're from Missouri. You're from Iowa. Cool. Try to find common ground. If it's a fighter who I know and I have a friendship with, or at least a good, healthy professional relationship with, I might ask them about their family. I might tell them something about my kids, just so we're easing into that. And if they start to give me answers that I feel like are trite answers, I'll say, you understand why I'm doing this, right? This is for me to see how you're fighting. So, you know, if you want to say something you think your opponent's going to hear, they're never going to hear this. That's not what this is about. You know, because you'll, and it's always the youngest, least experienced fighters, you know. If I'm the first time, tell me what type of fighter you are all around. No. Are you aggressive? Are you a cerebral fighter? Are you counter? Okay, I got it. They realize that they don't have to build that wall up and try to impress you, because I'm not looking for those types of answers. Or I'll have fighters say, you know, I don't want to say anything bad about my opponent. I'll say, that's not what this is about. You can't trash talk if someone never hears your answers. I don't care how you feel about your opponent. I want to know why you feel this way about your opponent. That solves it. I'm fortunate in my career now where more often than not, fighters know who I am. So there's that level of comfort. But I can tell you, on the last BKFC card, you know, there were a few fighters who walked in, no clue who I am, no clue who Chris Lytle is. So we have to put them at ease. You know, why am I here? Why am I answering these relatively detailed questions that I'm trying to hold on to this information? And I've even had to say, look, I understand you've done a lot of media interviews. I'm not the media. I'm a commentator. Two totally different agendas here.
Has there ever been any times, and you don't have to name names, but any like obscure or funny or strange answers where you thought to yourself, I'm probably not going to use that, but it may be funny for the audience?
Oh, but I do use them, and that's fun. I do use them. Now, I will tell you that I shut down I shut down questions. I'll get a lot of, if I'm getting someone for the first time, you know, so did you wrestle in high school, wrestle in college? Well, I wrestled in high school and I was a two-time state qualifier. And then I got a girl pregnant. I was like, oh, no, I'm all about the good here. It's fine. Or, yeah, you know, I got in some trouble when I was in college. I'm like, hey, that's not what this interview is about. That's all cool human interest that I have no interest in as a human. I want to know about your background as a wrestler. But whoever you impregnated or whatever you drank or smoked, that's honest to God, none of my business. And that will never make the broadcast anyway. So I'm steering in those directions. But when I was in M1, I had two stints in M1. I had a fighter named Niels Van Noord. And Jimmy Smith would always ask the question, how do you see yourself ending this fight? And it's a great question. Jimmy would be soliciting, you know, I think with a knockout punch, or I think I can submit him, or I think it's going to be ground and pound. He said, I think I can win by split decision. Jimmy said, really? He said, yeah, I want to test myself. I want to win by split decision. I thought, wow, that's great. And maybe eight or 9,000 fighter interviews. That's the only time I've heard that. And of course we use that on the broadcast. Mike Perry, who's a really witty person, and we put it on the broadcast on Knuckle Mania. He said, if I break my hand, I hope the bone sticks out of my skin and then I will stab Julian Lane. I thought that was so witty. And we put that in the broadcast. So as long as it's not personal, where stuff that I don't consider any of my business, any odd thing like that, I adore that. I love that because that just goes to, I think, the color and the nuance of the broadcast.
We kind of stopped ship at Pride. If you could kind of tell us your journey from Pride to now.
Yeah. So again, Pride was my break. Jerry Millen, who had never heard of me because he wasn't a soccer fan, gave me a chance. And Jerry Millen said to me when he knew the Pride, and I was at Pride again, I was at the very end, I was the last English language commentator. Jerry Millen said to me, Sean, you're my guy. I don't know what's next, but I know you're going to be my guy. And a couple of months later came M1. And when Jerry Millen heard about this thing called Bellator Fighting Championship that was coming online, Jerry got on a plane from where he lived in Detroit to Chicago, met with Bjorn Rebney and said, I have two guys, you need to hire them. Their names are Sean Wheelock and Jimmy Smith. And had Jerry not done that, I don't think that Bjorn would have even been aware of Jimmy and myself to hire us, and did that. So I owe Jerry Millen a lot. There's a man named Sam Kaplan, who is a great promoter. He actually started the website 5 Ounces of Pain. He's out of the industry now. Sam was a huge advocate of mine who looked out for me. Bjorn Rebney took great care of me. David Feldman at Bare Knuckle has looked out for me. There's a person who was a research producer who passed away a few years ago prematurely. He had cancer in his early 30s, named Adam Geller. Adam would tell anyone who we met, this is the guy to hire. It's a strange thing, though. I did Titan. Titan got me to Pride. Jerry Millen took me from Pride to M1 from Bellator. I did 5.5 years at Bellator. I wasn't sure what was next. And thankfully, right after, I got 3 gigs. I got Titan, the new Titan, the post Joe Kelly, the Jeff Aronson, Lex McMahon Titan. I got Victory Fighting Championship, and I got one championship. And then M1 brought me back. David Feldman brought me to BKFC, starting as a consultant. And I was there from the beginning on that, which has been amazing. So as I said earlier in our interview, no straight lines. It's odd. You know, there have been some jobs I've very aggressively gone for, and I don't get those. I haven't done that in a while, but I certainly have within the last 5 years, and I don't get those jobs. It's a strange thing when you're a commentator. Some people just naturally respond to you, and some people naturally don't. I mean, Bellator for me is the best example. I worked for a guy named Bjorn Rebney who literally thought that I was the greatest commentator in the history of commentating. He's gone. They bring in a new regime who thinks that I'm the worst commentator in history of commentating. Nothing about me changed. The people who were the decision makers, that's what changed. That's how fickle this business is.
I think I'm right in saying that you actually helped start BKFC as a consultant, right?
No, it's interesting you know that. Not a lot of people know that. So BKFC, and I've got that poster behind me too, June 2nd, 2018, but I was a full 24 months in with David Feldman. We were introduced by a mutual friend, And he talked to me about being a commentator. And I said, you know, aside from commentating, I kind of have this little side thing going as a regulator. I've been appointed as a commission member of the Kansas Athletic Commission in 2015. I was heading up MMA Rules and Regs Committee. And I said, I can help you get regulated. I'm running those circles. I go to the Association of Boxing Commission meetings. I'm on a commission. I can help you get regulated. So I couldn't do it in Kansas because of conflict of interest. And even when it came time to vote for Bare Knuckle, I had to recuse myself from the vote. But in Wyoming, as we moved into Mississippi, Florida, around the country, no, I was there. I remember fondly being in David Feldman's office with his son, David Jr. And we're sitting in his office in Philadelphia, and we're on the phone to Brian Pedersen, who is, was then and still is, the head of the Wyoming Athletic Commission, saying, yep, green light, here we go. And I think that was February or March of 2018. We looked at each other and we're like, wow, this is really going to happen. So that's a great question. Yeah. Not many people know that, but 2 years on as a consultant, always with the expectation, once we got it started, I would be the play-by-play commentator. But no, I'm really proud of the fact that not just what we were able to accomplish, but that David Feldman saw something in me, something beyond just being a commentator, someone who we thought could help him in regulating Bare Knuckle. And I'm so happy that we were able to get that done and continue to get more commissions online.
I'm assuming, obviously, you were consulting with the rules, regulations, the HAMRAPs, the doctors, and what kind of stumbling blocks did you face on the way?
Everyone thought it was a horrible idea. They thought it was the worst idea they had ever heard. But you know,
similar to the UFC, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say. So I talked about Art Davey earlier in our book. You know, Art Davey, I've only known him 12 years, but he's really become later in life like a father to me. I was raised by my mom. I was very close to my own dad. My dad passed away in 2011. Art has really filled a lot of that later in life father role. He's actually listed as dad in my phone. My two daughters, Ellie and Hadley, call him Grandpa Art. He's that type of person. And knowing the stories of Art Davey, knowing that when he was in Michigan in UFC in Detroit, and he had to get out quickly because there was actually a warrant for his arrest because they had denied the closed fist punch order. And Art had a warrant issued for his arrest, that the New York Times runs an editorial that says death is cheap, but only costs $14.95, referencing the pay-per-view price. The fact that he's watching Larry King live and there's Senator John McCain calling his baby, his passion project, the UFC human cockfighting. I understood the perseverance. You know, Art Davey spent 4 years of his life creating the UFC. The vast majority of that time spent being told no by fighters, by commissioners, by regulatory bodies, by television networks. So I've always naturally had an underdog personality. Anyway, I gravitate to that. And I think David Feldman and I saw kindred spirits. So I was happy to join in on that. But that was it. It was that this is a horrible idea. Why would you do that? People are going to get killed. They're going to get concussed. They're going to break their hands. This is the worst thing I've ever heard. But I remember being around the Midwest circuit in the 90s when I was a kid. And I remember hearing things like that MMA. So you mean to tell me one guy can get on top of another guy on the ground and punch him in the face? That's the worst idea I've ever heard. People saw what bare knuckle was. You know, there's always perception and there's reality. And people perceived bare knuckle to be one thing, and the reality was far different. And the medical data has backed up the fact that there are fewer concussions and traumatic brain injuries in bare knuckle than there are in professional MMA, professional boxing. Actually, fewer hand breaks. Now, that surprised me. I didn't think there would be a lot, but fewer hand breaks in bare knuckle than in professional boxing or MMA. I understand why now. It's the wrap, and it's because you're not throwing full force like you do when you have a glove on. But I knew it would be safe. I knew it would be big. Credit to Wyoming and Brian Pedersen and Jeremy Arneson, who was there at the time, commission, and a man named Nick Meeker, who's now the executive director of Wyoming. They were willing to be first, a bit of that pioneer spirit, right? Saying, we're going to be first. I'd said to David Feldman for 2 years, all it takes is that one, because once we get one, it'll come quickly. And as soon as we did Wyoming, we got Mississippi and Florida, and then my home state of Kansas right after that in sequence. Someone had to be brave enough to say, yes, this is the first time. Just like Art Davey found Colorado. They had to be brave enough to say yes to UFC 1 in Denver. and Wyoming and Cheyenne, they were brave enough to say yes to BKFC one. I heard one state, and I don't want to say this state because I like the commission and I like the executive director, but they said, we're not going to be first in anything in this state. And I thought, yeah, it pretty much sums up the bureaucratic attitude that you deal with a lot.
How many states is it legal at the minute?
So we haven't gone to everyone, but I think it's around 18. So for instance, we can do it in New Mexico. We haven't yet. We can do it in Utah. We haven't yet. Vermont is another one, New Hampshire. So I don't know the exact tally, but I believe it to be about 18. And quite frankly, there are a lot of commissions who will say yes. They just haven't been asked yet, because outside of BKFC, I know Ken Shamrock's group is doing another show. You have BYB, which is not a 5,000s group. You get a few house shows, a few random cards, and even stray fights on a boxing or an MMA card. But there hasn't been a lot of bare knuckle the way that there was a lot of MMA early after UFC one. That does surprise me a little bit. So states that are open, like Utah and New Mexico, just haven't done it yet. But with an aggressive push, I don't see why it couldn't be in the 30s. There are some states that just don't like it, to which I say, hey, cool, that's fine. You know, I don't like bowling. I don't think bowling should be banned. I'm just not particularly a fan of bowling. I don't choose to bowl or watch bowling, but it's fine if you guys want to do it. I have nothing against bowling. I'm not a fan. And I take that approach with bare knuckle. You know, some states just don't like it. That's fine. I'm not going to, as a regulator now, as someone who's working on the rules and reg side, not as a commentator, but on that regulatory affairs side, I'm not going to try to convince someone to do anything. What I'm looking for are states who are open-minded about bare knuckle, who either want to do it or think that they probably want to do it. Let's get them legalized. Let's get them sanctioned. Let's figure out how they're going to do it safely and effectively and efficiently. The states who say, nope, I don't like it, it's not for me, that's fine, because we'll move on to plenty of states and plenty of commissions who are open to it. It's the same path as MMA. I mean, you think how long it took to get, there are 47 athletic commissions right now. Montana doesn't have one. Alaska doesn't have one. Vermont doesn't, but 47 athletic commissions with states in the U.S. plus all the tribal commissions. Think how long it took to get New York online. Mm-hmm. You know, the UFC was in its third decade. It was over 20 years old in decade number three before New York came online with pro MMA. So it's a process, and I get that.
How quickly do you think you'll get into, obviously, you know, boxing and MMA are huge, and, you know, California and Nevada. How quickly do you think you'll conquer those two?
You know, it's not even a target, because I understand there's opposition to it. So for me, it's let's get the Iowas and Minnesotas and Louisianas, the states that seem like they're willing and interested, let's get them. And then when we have basically everyone who wants to do it, then at the very last home stretch of this process, let's go after the states that are resistant, and let's show them the medical data of why this is safe. Let's show them why it's a real combat sport. Let's show them why they should regulate that. Let's show them all the benefits. And I think that will be the end process. So that's probably states named New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Nevada, and California would be my best guess on that. But again, I don't want to expend energy on a state who has to be talked into anything. I either want them ready and willing to do it or open-minded to say, yes, we're strongly considering that. That was what we had with Utah. Utah was very open to it. I had met their commissioners. Scott Bowler, who was a Lions Den fighter, is their executive director. They were open-minded. They weren't actively seeking it, but they were open-minded. And we talked. I spoke at a commission meeting. They voted, and now they have bare knuckle in Utah.
After the first, you know, event or two, did you see bare knuckle growing as fast as it has?
Yeah, I really did. My only surprise in all of this, my only real surprise, the hand fractures are fewer. I knew like it wouldn't be a broken hand fest, because I knew with the wrap, I thought there would be more. I didn't think it would be substantially less than MMA and boxing. I thought it would be about the same. That's a slight surprise. I knew this sport would explode. I knew people would love it. I knew it would be safe. I knew there would be very few concussions. All of that I knew. My surprise is that there is not a huge competitor to BKFC. And the co-surprise is you haven't seen a lot of the mom and pop shows for whatever reason. COVID probably plays a big part in that. Where you are seeing the mom and pop shows or in countries like Russia, Ukraine, Poland. You're not seeing that a lot. In my home state of Kansas, we'll get a house show MMA, a mom and pop MMA, and they'll stick two bare knuckle on. That's what we're getting. But I think it's coming. I think you're going to see more and more. Part of that is that there's no such thing as amateur bare knuckle. And so many house shows you go to, there might be eight AMI MMA fights and then two or three pro fights. So it might be a little cost prohibitive there. But again, it's coming. There's going to be a big challenger, whether it's someone who emerges from who's already there or someone new. There's eventually going to be a big challenger to BKFC. There's no doubt about that. You know, look at the challenges that are the challengers that UFC had 4 years on. Pride comes online. A lot have come and gone, you know, Pro Elite, Strikeforce. There are going to be challenges. That's just the nature of capitalism and the open market. There are going to be more house shows. I'm not surprised how big BKFC is. I knew it would be this huge. I'm just surprised there's not more on the grassroots level.
Big news for BKFC yesterday with the announcement from David Feldman that Triller have, I believe, taken the majority stake.
Correct.
What news can you reveal from that? What new things will happen?
Yeah, I guess I'm the only person who's worked for both. You know, I started with Triller and then into a consultancy role initially with them, one of many to commentate the Askren Paul card in April of last year in Atlanta. And Ryan Kavanaugh, who owns Triller, is an amazing guy. He's a genuinely good human being. I knew it would be a great fit. I knew that BKFC was looking for investors and to be bigger and more financial stability. And the nature of it is when a promotion grows, you're going to attract money. There have been a lot of people who have come at David Feldman wanting to give him money and come on. David Feldman did his due diligence. He felt that Triller was the right fit. Maybe perhaps, and I don't want to take credit, the fact that he knows that I've been commentating for Triller and I've had great experiences and I know that Ryan Kavanaugh to be a first-class human being, maybe that helped. I don't know the financials. If I did, I would tell you I know them and I can't reveal them. I legitimately don't know the financials. I'm sure it was something that made sense to both sides. From what I do for BKFC, I believe that it gives full financial stability. That I would imagine, and I'm speculating here, I would imagine Ryan Kavanaugh will say to David Feldman, this is your budget for the year, go out, and then I'm not going to micromanage you, because the guy, Ryan Kavanaugh, is not a micromanager at all. He puts smart people in positions of power and leaves them alone. I think it allows BKFC to do more shows, go after bigger free agents, pay more money, have bigger cards, more Knucklemania-esque type cards, but it's really financial stability. Not that I ever felt financial instability since day one, because I knew every show I felt that we were getting bigger, attracting more attention, attracting more followers, more fans, more people who wanted to be around it. But now this solidifies that security. Triller is going to be a publicly traded company this year. You know, it's not just Triller Fight Club. There's all the social media, all the app, all the entertainment that they do. It's a multi-billion dollar company that BKFC is now a part of, but that will still run autonomously as BKFC.
It must be paying well. You know, I've seen Chad Mendes, Mike Perry, Paige Van Zandt, Artem Lobov, Paulie Malignaggi. You know, they've attracted some big names since starting only 3 years ago.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I have fighters all the time ask me, like, what does BKFC pay? I don't know. You know, that's one conversation we never have. Fighters don't say, hey, Sean, what are you and Chris getting paid to commentate this? And I'm not asking them. I don't know. It's something, I'm a pretty private person, and I don't ask a lot of personal questions, and I don't really want a lot of personal questions. So it never comes up. I have zero idea what anybody got on that card. Obviously, it's got to be competitive because you're getting someone like Mike Perry, who I'm sure could have gone to PFL or Bellator or One Championship or ACA easily. I'm sure they're paying a lot. I'm sure Paige Van Zandt gets paid a lot and it's competitive, but I don't know the pay structure. It's enough to where they can keep paying people and they're not overpaying because they keep bringing in more big names. No one ever seems unhappy. I mean, I can just tell you my experience. BKFC continues to always pay me a great rate. There's never an issue of chasing money. Any fighters watching who wonder about it, there's not one story out about someone getting stiffed on their money or paid late. The finances have always been A++ with BKFC.
Do you have a combat sports bucket list? Is there anything else that you, any aims that you've got before you retire?
So it's funny. It's just places I want to go. You know, for the longest time, I wanted to be a UFC commentator, and I think that's natural. You know, I look, I'm friends with John Anik. I think John is awesome. I'm not a fan of most play-by-play commentators. I really like John, and I think John is great. I see what he's asked to do with the UFC, and I see the style of broadcast. I don't think I would be a fit for them. And I think if I were, they probably would have hired me by now. You know, I'm not famous. I'm not extremely well-known. I don't regard myself as a celebrity, but in the fight world, if you're a decision maker, you probably have a good idea of who I am. So the fact that the UFC has never reached out tells me I'm probably not a great fit for them. 10 years ago, I would have been willing to do certain things with my commentary that I'm just unwilling to do at this point. If the UFC called, I'm not leaving BKFC and I'm not leaving Triller. But yeah, I mean, you're going to listen to offers. I'm not going to do it at the expense of either of those two, because they're dream job and dream job now together, hopefully in one big dream job. That would have been cool, but it's never anything like, wow, I wish I could have commentated for the UFC. I want to work for people who understand what they're getting with me. They understand my style and they're not going to try to change me or remake me. That was one of the reasons it went very, very wrong with Bellator after Bjorn Rebny was gone. They wanted me to become a different person and a different commentator, and wasn't too keen on that. There's a streak of oppositional tendencies. My mom has it. My wife has it. My girls have it. I certainly have it. If we feel like we're right, it's tough. We don't really succumb to bullying or peer pressure very well, but you know, the UFC is cool. Anik does a fantastic job. Again, I don't know that my style, I'm a pretty technical play-by-play commentator. I don't know that would fit. For me, it's really more about countries. Someone actually reached out to Art Davey. They were trying to do something in Africa, and they wanted to do an MMA promotion in East Africa and in Rwanda, in Kigali. And I've read two books on Rwanda, and I'm fascinated by that country. And I said, Art, if you can help me get to Kigali, Rwanda, I'll go commentate for free for one show. They just have to pay my travel. So it would be experiences of going to places that I've not been. I've been so fortunate, man. Michael, I've done MMA or at least some form of combat sports commentating in 26 countries. I'd love to go to New Zealand. I would love to go to Rwanda. That would be cool. But in terms of the promotions, I couldn't be happier with who I'm with. It feels like the pinnacle for me. It feels like dream job. I don't want to do other sports outside of combat sports. If Manchester United does another summer tour of the United States and it's about 3 or 4 matches and they want to hire me, awesome. I'm in for that. But in terms of the regular gigs, no, I'm really, really happy with combat sports. And, you know, I've got a few other shows that I commentate, but the core for me is BKFC and Triller. And they treat me beautifully, and I can't see myself wanting to go anywhere else.
It sounds terrible, Sean. I'm not jealous at all. Do you have a favorite country and a favorite arena so far?
Yeah, man, great question. So, you know, it might be politically slippery to say with what's going on, but I've had nothing but wonderful experiences with Russia. I've been there about 30 times, and I've been all through the country because I had 2 stints in M1, and I did a boxing there as well. So, you know, if Americans or Brits or Western Europeans or Canadians go off, they either go to St. Petersburg or Moscow. But I've been to Ingushetia, I've been to Vladikavkaz, I've been to Rostov-on-Don, I've been to Kazan. I love the Russian people. I love Russia. I love the Russian culture so much. So I actually went native and I have Russian Cyrillic tattoos. My daughters, Ellie and Hadley, that's how much I love Russia. Again, I'm sorry, geopolitics. I'm not talking their government or their leadership. I'm talking the people, the culture. I am so happy every time I go to Russia. I adore it. Another country that, and I don't want to talk geopolitics, but the democratically elected government was overthrown is Myanmar. Myanmar, I've been there multiple times for World Lightweight Championship. People would always say, do you feel unsafe going to Myanmar? I was like, are you kidding? Those are like genuinely the nicest people I've ever met in my life. And I'm from Kansas. So that's a bold statement. They're like nicer than Canadians. Adore Myanmar, but with all of the unrest there and the military coup, I don't see myself going back anytime soon. I've heard World Lightweight Championship might restart, but possibly in Japan or Thailand. But man, what an amazing country, amazing culture. You know, I'm someone who naturally, I think, sees the good in people, the good in places. I'll go anywhere. And I kind of have a philosophy that even if I go to a place and it's a bad hotel and a bad arena and a bad fight car and I don't like the city, it's still a great experience. It's still super cool that I've been there. I always wanted to commentate. I love fights. I always wanted to travel. So that's why you don't hear me complain.
What would you say is the biggest differences in all of the countries you've been? Because you watch some fights where I think it's like the Japanese, they're very quiet and they'll just clap like in between the rounds. What would you say is the biggest differences and what has surprised you?
Yeah, so it's funny that in Russia, I've never, and again, this is a lot of fights, about 30 shows. I've never sensed that there was a concept of like trash talking. Early in M1, we had an interpreter, and she would always translate athletes as sport or fighters as sportsmen. And I always thought that was kind of quaint. And I realized, no, that is really what she's trying to say. They're sportsmen, sportswomen. They have sportsmanship. And Nate the Train Landwehr, who I love, he's a good friend. He's in the UFC now. And when I first met Nate in M1, and Nate's a big trash talker. And we're at the weigh-ins and he's trash talking his opponent and going on big histrionics and big personality and yelling. And they were just mystified. They didn't know how to react because that's just not in the culture of Russians or largely Central Asians and Eastern Europeans to trash talk. That's a big deal to see that. It's much more athletic competition-like when you do fights in Eastern Europe, in my experience. It feels less like fights and more like a competition, like maybe this could be rival tennis teams or rival volleyball teams coming to compete against each other. Japan, yeah, you said that. I've done boxing and MMA, Pride M1, and then as well as boxing in Japan. The crowds dress really nice, usually better than how I dress as a commentator. You never hear boos, derisive whistles, appropriate applause, implied applause. Just difference in how the crowd reacts. And that's part of the fascination for me because I love experiencing new cultures. How does a crowd in Myanmar perceive a fight as opposed to a crowd in Brazil, as opposed to a crowd in Russia, as opposed to a crowd in Kansas City? I love all of that.
What would you say is the biggest misconception about your job? I'm sure everyone thinks it's five-star travel, you know, first class on the plane, just hanging out with celebrity fighters.
It's that I show up the day of the fights. That's not people in the industry, but like fans will be like, I've had people, you know, like it'll be like, I'm on air at 7, I'll be at 4, be like, hey, have you landed yet? I was like, yeah, 4 days ago. And I understand that, you know, I believe that nobody really understands what anyone else does for a living. I don't really know what an architect does. I don't really know what an ear, nose, and throat doctor does. I don't know what a federal judge does. I have an idea. I don't really know what they do for a living. So fair enough. I understand that. But as a commentator, you're there, at least you should be. You're prepping, you're doing that. The idea is you just kind of fly into the city, you show up, you put on a headset, you talk into a microphone, you get on a plane and you leave. That's it. You know, if people ask me what I do for a living, I tell them I travel for a living. Because that really is what it is. It deflects a lot of questions too about, oh, fighting. Oh, and then, you know, oh, my grandson does Taekwondo. You get a lot of those, but you have to love to travel. And I love to travel. You know, I did a couple of years ago, I did Karate Combat in New York, got off air, took a cab to JFK, flew from JFK in New York to Taipei, changed planes, went into Yangon, Myanmar, called World Lightweight Championship, got up the next morning and flew home. And I loved every second of it. You have to love that. If you don't love that part of it, the rest of this business doesn't make sense.
If we sadly retired you today, what would be the most memorable events that you'd look back on?
Pride, the first Pride, because I was such a Pride fan. And that was my first big show in MMA. That was really amazing. BKFC one is the co-number one on that. In Wyoming that whole week, Art Davey had always told me about the camaraderie he felt amongst everybody at UFC one. And I felt that fighters, even opponents getting together. How did you train for this? Oh, I wore 16 ounce gloves. Oh man, I was hitting in wraps. Oh, I was hitting bare fisted. No. I was sparring in MMA gloves. That is such a special show to me. That's as close. I watched UFC one live on pay-per-view. I wasn't there. I watched it. I was in the live audience, but knowing Art Davies' stories, knowing John McCarthy's stories, knowing some of the fighter stories from UFC one, that's as close as I'll ever get to experiencing that with BKFC one. So Pride, my first Pride, which I think was Pride 30. I should know the number. I think that was Pride 37, maybe. I don't know. But I know it was BKFC one. Those are the two biggest shows for me by far.
What's the story behind the 2 liter bottle of Mountain Dew that's always in the Instagram pictures?
So I've done that for years. I'm a hopeless caffeine addict. And in my real life, my day-to-day life, I'll take either my older daughter or my younger daughter to school. My wife will trade off who drives who. I'll stop in my local convenience store and I will get my diet Mountain Dew. I'm a hopeless caffeine addict. I generally, like tonight, for instance, I'm not consuming it in the evening. I found out early in my career that it is the perfect drink for me because if I can sip it throughout and room temperature, and I learned this from voiceover people, you want to drink it at room temperature, a soda or any liquid room temperature, keeps me hydrated. It keeps me alert. It's a lot of caffeine in Diet Mountain Dew with no sugar. It's my thing. I've done this for years. I mean, years. Like talk to people who've worked with me at M1 or World Lightweight Championship or Pride, and they'll tell you about how in my checked luggage, I brought 2 liter bottles over because it's a virtually impossible drink to find outside of the US and Canada, especially the diet. So last year at Knuckle Mania, Phil Lambert, who's our great photographer, gets a shot of me at the end of the night. We're off air and I'm finishing my 2 liter. So I'm like this, and he posts on Instagram. Nate Shook, our matchmaker for BKFC, is like, wow, that was really clever how Phil photoshopped that in. I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, yeah, he photoshopped that in. How'd you guys do that? I go, dude, how long have we worked together? I was like, you don't know that I drink Diet Mountain Dew and I have a 2 liter bottle at every show? He goes, no, I never noticed. The very next week, I'm doing Lion Fight in Wyoming on UFC Fight Pass. So literally as an inside joke for one person, Nate Shook, I get a photo taken of me and I'm like, I told you I do this at every show. Put it on Instagram. It got a big response. I'm like, okay, yeah, you might be onto something here. Next week I had a show. I think I was doing Roy Jones Jr. boxing in Mexico or somewhere. And I did the same thing. So my 16-year-old daughter, Ellie, runs my Instagram. So she loves it. So we get the photo. It's just become a thing. A million people have said, oh, I can get you a Diet Mountain Dew sponsorship. Never came to fruition. 2 weeks ago, Diet Mountain Dew actually reached out. So I think they're going to sponsor me. At least they've threatened to sponsor me. We will see. But in pro wrestling parlance, it is definitely a shoot. It is not a work. I really drink a 2 liter of Diet Mountain Dew. Depending on the evening and timing my bathroom breaks, sometimes I'm off air and I finished it. Sometimes there's a little bit left. But over the course of that 6 or 7 hours or 8 hours I'm at the venue, that whole thing is going to go down throughout the night.
And I'm sure most people are thinking it works better than coffee. That's why
it does for me. And again, it's not a drink for everyone. John McCarthy drinks it weirdly too. I only know a few people and he's one of my best friends. I don't know what that means. He likes Diet Mountain Dew. When I've stayed at his house, he always has it in the fridge for me, which is awesome. And he drinks it as well. Right. But again, it's a lot of caffeine, no sugar, room temperature, you know, and it's psychological at this point too, is that I believe that I need it to keep hydrated, keep my vocal cords wet, to keep my energy up. You know, it's all psychosomatic. I get that. But if I believe it, then it's probably true. And I just really like the taste of Diet Mountain Dew.
And to finish, Sean, any advice for anyone who's listening today that wants to follow in your footsteps, what would
You, you know, and I'm glad you asked that. And I really, really pride myself on being accessible to people and people who want to get into this business. I was about to say young people, you don't have to be young. Anybody, any age can get into this business, right? Is that I'm from Shawnee, Kansas, a little suburb of Kansas City. I was raised by a single mom who's a public school art teacher. She's retired now. Had no connections to sports, entertainment, showbiz, television, radio, broadcasting, print, anything. I willed myself into this business, not through talent, but through perseverance. And that if you want to get into this business, you can get into this business. What happens is a whole weird mixture of quirks of fate and timing and whatever else, but you can get into this business. That is the message to leave everybody. I was always the person who thought, oh, why not? It might as well be me. Someone's got to be there talking, commentating. Why not me? That's what I would say. You know, how the career goes, it's almost not up to you at that point in a weird way. But what is up to you is perseverance to get yourself into this business.
If you want to tell everybody where they can find you on Instagram and Twitter and any shows or any announcements that you have coming up.
Absolutely. So Instagram, and that's my 16-year-old daughter, Ellie, who runs it for me. I think I should know. I believe it's Sean Wheelock Official. Just look for fight photos and Diet Mountain Dew photos. That's on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. It's at Sean Wheelock. Those are my two big social media platforms. I don't do a lot on Facebook. I think, Michael, help me out on this. I think if you put it on Instagram, I think it goes on Facebook automatically.
But yeah, it has like an option, yeah.
Right. So I'll have to get my IT consultant down here to talk about that. But anybody who reaches out to me, direct messages them, I will always respond to them. And I'm known to get people free tickets to go to fights if they reach out. So I'm always happy to hear from people. I always appreciate it. People are infinitely kind to me on social media, which means a lot.
And we are TLR MMA on Instagram and Twitter. And join us next time for the last round.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Last Round MMA podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and interviews. In the meantime, follow the Last Round MMA on Twitter and Instagram at TLRMMA. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Last Round MMA podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and interviews. In the meantime, follow the Last Round MMA on Twitter and Instagram at TLRMMA.